I'm Charles Breton.
And I'm Chris Henson.
And we are a Jew
and a Gentile
walk into a bar mitzvah.
Welcome to our podcast. This is episode 44.
And I'm still a Gentile.
Very much so. And I'm still the Jew. And this is podcast.
You're not the Jew. I mean, there are others.
Well, I'm your Jew.
That you could say. Well, I can say. You're one amongst several, actually.
Yeah, we're a growing tribe.
I'm hearing good things.
Hearing good things. So this is our podcast where we try to seek answers to burning questions, such as, did Abraham use a V-cut or double guillotine cutter when he circumcised himself and all of his servants? So we also at the top of our podcast, let it go, Chris, just let it go. Let's get to our sponsors.
I'm not even going to tell, maybe he bit it off. I mean, you know, it's.
Well, only if he's Steve Bannon. Gross. Could he do that? So we're acknowledging our sponsors, Men of the Beard, Beard Oil, our good friend, Pastor Narm, Brandon Moser, who we met at, a couple years ago, also Virgil Kane. Rye whiskey. They also make good bourbon, and they're coming out with a new ginger, I believe.
Yeah,
bourbon. We're gonna have to try that. And of course, our favorite place in the whole wide world, our favorite sponsor is the Pipe and Pint.
Is that the one on Spring Garden in Greensboro?
It just happens to be the one in Spring Garden in Greensboro with Larry and Chris there. So, Chris, what are you smoking today?
Well, actually, if I'm going to be honest, which occasionally I like to be, it's the one we had a few weeks ago. We were celebrating. It's a Romeo y Julieta number 2. It's a Petite Corona, and it's a Cuban Puro, which I'm pretty sure it's our first Cuban review on this show. I mean, well, other than the one I gave you because you're no longer unemployed, Professor Charles.
I'm semi-employed.
Semi is the best we can expect at this point. But
we take what we can get.
Well, that's what Mrs. Dr. Jew says.
Yeah.
So many ways.
Twice on Shabbos.
Gross.
Except for this one, we're fasting. So.
Oh, well. But why do they call it fasting? It goes so damn slow. Yeah. Wrapper's Cuban, binder's Cuban, filler's Cuban. I just wanted to say that even though Cuban Puro said it. I just want to say Cuban that many more times.
And yeah. Really rub it in. Go right in.
Really rub it in. Fine. Yeah. Tasting notes, kind of a toasted bread going on in there, coffee, leather, and just a hint of vanilla. Not a lot of notes, but notes well hit. On pitch, as it were. Yeah.
Yeah.
Charles. What are you smoking?
I'm smoking the La Galera 1936 box pressed. And as you know, box pressed is one of my favorite shapes because it's perfect golf cigar because it does not roll off the T marker. And it has an Ecuador and Habano wrapper, Dominican Criollo 98 binder, which is still probably one of the best leafs ever. Dominican Piloto Cubano and Criollo 98 filler. So it's got the Creo in the binder and the filler. And it's got that nice soft spice and creamy cedar as you light it up. And then you get that damped earth and mixed spices that tends to come with that Dominican Piloto. And the more you get into it, then you start picking up some white, some pepper and a little anise.
Good inclusive description there. Just pepper, not white.
One's more of a black pepper.
Now you got to bring race into it.
Yeah. Yeah. But I smoke it on one knee. I'll take a knee. I'll take a knee for this cigar. That's for sure.
Wow. That derailed even quicker than
it
usual.
It did. But, you know, it is the elephant in the room and not just because of the party involved. So I just wanted to put out there, we've pinned to our Twitter page. At least my feeling, and you haven't taken it down, so I guess you agree, that in this whole debate, it's not tweets that are divisive, it's not rhetoric that's divisive, it's not protests that are divisive. Racism is what is divisive.
No, I didn't take it down. I didn't realize we had a Twitter feed. Is that the case? What else are you telling me?
You should follow us. Then.
How can I follow us if I'm us?
Well, because
you know what? Let's move on.
Move on. Take us to our special guest, please.
We are blessed to have a gentleman on, a fellow chaplain, Reverend David Finnegan Hosey. We met him back at the Wild Goose Festival in July, which for those that are interested, it's the second or third week of July every year, right?
Yeah, it's usually the weekend. I think it's going to be the 12th through the 16th this year.
Yeah, so whenever
it's Thursday through Sunday.
Yeah, whenever it's hot and rainy, that's when it'll be. We met and went to one of his groups where he introduced a book that he's coming out with called Christ on the Psych Ward. I mean, when I read that just in the bios of the people coming to present, I was like, that was highlighted, you know, as boldly as I could get. I mean, I used the whole rainbow of highlighters because we were going to go to that. David, as I understand, starting his residency in chaplaincy or continuing residency next week is October. But he's a writer, songwriter, podcaster, spouse, and pet parent.
Well, David, he's the pet of Penny. He's Penny's human pet.
That's right. Yeah.
do we tick all the boxes, David?
That sounds good to me.
well, you're the expert on you at this point, so.
Yeah. So I'm actually. I guess I should clarify. So I'm starting my first unit of CPE. And I'm a residential chaplain, hence the confusion. So I the residential piece of the residential chaplain is I actually live in a residence hall here at Georgetown University and work with students here. So
not too shabby.
So yeah. my
good,
wife,
good Jesuit school.
Yeah, good Jesuit school. And my wife is a chaplain in residence with me and is also doing her residency at the hospital. So she's a chaplain in residency or something like that.
Resident chaplain in residence.
Residency.
Okay.
Yeah. which is confusing sounding, but it basically means for the next two or three years, you're not going to see each other.
Yeah. If it's no, anything I don't, like, yeah. I don't remember what she looks like. Yeah.
Well, wow.
Well, we'll have her on the podcast next week.
That'll be good. Yeah.
And then you could at least hear her voice.
Yeah.
The next. Nice. The next book's going to be Christ in the Trauma Unit for that comment. Christ in the Divorce Court. No, too early.
We spit on that, and that's don't send out those bad vibes.
Yeah,
always with the bad vibes, Moriarty.
Yeah,
cool it with the negative waves.
Yeah, everybody under 30 didn't get the reference to Kelly's Heroes there.
No,
but it's so. A shame. The neat thing is that David's book is already available for pre-order on Amazon. Again, that's Christ on the Psych Ward. It's coming out spring of next year, spring of 2018. And David, just want to kind of, I mean, I got the bio a bit on your page, but just kind of take us into this project that's really both sounds like witness and sort of personal disclosure, some wounded healer maybe mixed in there. Just, yeah, how would you describe this work?
Yeah, sure. it's, I guess where it started is, in 2011, I had a really awful week and kind of from the outside didn't seem like anything was going on, but it was really kind of falling apart internally and ended up at the end of that week with the help of some friends, admitting myself into a psychiatric ward at a hospital here in D.C., which was a first for me. It was a new experience. I was there for about 2 weeks and then got out and was like, great, I can go back to normal. And after a few weeks, I was back in. And I spent the next about 6 months kind of bouncing in and out of various hospitals until I ended up in a kind of more of a long-term program at a hospital in Connecticut. Was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, type 2 bipolar disorder, which I can kind of, you know, get into the differences if people are interested in that. But that was the first time in my life I'd kind of received a diagnosis of mental illness, but it made a lot of sense of some experiences I'd been having since I was a teenager of just real marked mood instability and these periods of kind of a mixture of anxiety and depression, but also sort of not being able to sit still and kind of being really agitated and kind of sometimes really aggressive, which isn't really my like go-to personality. Was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and after I kind of had gotten out of the hospitals and had stabilized a little bit, I came back to DC and started up what I had sort of an internship that I had planned to start a semester earlier, working with college students. And I wanted them to sort of know where I'd been, and lying seemed like it would be really exhausting. So I just sort of told the truth about what had been going on with me. And students started coming to me in this campus ministry and saying, hey, you know, I'm really glad you shared that story because I really struggle with depression or anxiety or mental illness and for myself or in my family. And sometimes I'm not sure if I can talk about it in church. And so you kind of telling that story helped us know this was sort of a safe place to talk about that. And I was like, okay. Yeah, I guess that's a thing. And that sort of for me was this eye-opening moment of realizing that, you know, now as I did ministry, I was a seminary student at the time. When I preach or I teach or I lead a Bible study or I counsel or I, you know, sit down and talk to a student, I was doing it as someone with a mental illness, right? That this was this lens that I now had that I, you know, had never intended to bring to the table, but there it was at the table with me. So this book is kind of a reflection back on that time and on some things that I've learned since then, both in terms of my own experience and also theologically, how I kind of wrap my head around some of those experiences, and also, you know, some practical questions of for faith communities, what do they do? How can they be sort of in faithful ministry with folks like me who suffer from mental illness? So that's kind of a general, at least sort of overview of the process, but yeah.
That's, I mean, just full disclosure, myself, I've had but two at the hospital I'm actually currently serving as the adult behavioral health chaplain, year of ECT. And so, and then just hearing you share that, you know, not that you needed the approval or praise, but thank you for breaking that silence. The courage to speak out, the courage to challenge stigma is just, it's huge. It is absolutely a blessing. I cannot, actually, you know what? I can't imagine what those students, your students felt like, because one of the first places I went in trying to get back into ministry was campus ministry, where I was the unofficial official chaplain in residence, but I didn't have a nice dormitory. I had a group of Lutheran and Methodist students to look after or to assist looking after. But thanks. And that's what drew me to the talk there at Wild Goose was, wow, we need more Davids, man. Definitely. Go ahead, Charles.
Yeah. And one of the things that you mentioned and that we wanted to bring up, and I think you kind of hit on leading you to the book, is the power of witness, that the reaction you got from your students when, you know, you were just filling them in, and yet they felt freed from that. And I think that really speaks to one of the major issues that I know Chris and I have written about and talked about and you're dealing with also is, you know, the stigmas within faith communities and just in general on mental illness and what that self-disclosure and witness can do, not just for you, but for others. Which kind of leads me to a question though, because you mentioned how, you know, you're going into this and before the hospitalization and the diagnosis, I'm sure you had an idea in your mind about what ministry was going to be and what, you know, pastoring to these students is going to be. And then you mentioned now that, you know, that lens is different. And now it's through the lens of someone, you're ministering as someone with bipolar. How has that changed your view of ministry and how you approach it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Yeah, I think when I initially sort of talked a bit with my students about what had been going on, both my impression of ministry and my impression of mental health and mental illness had to undergo this shift, because what I kind of thought is that I'd say, hey, you know, I had a really hard past 6 months and I'm okay now. And you kind of have to you don't have to worry about me anymore, you know? And then in this sort of realization that like both, that it wasn't just going to be kind of this return to normal, right? There had been this little, this hiccup or this disruption. And now I'm back to what I was doing before, which was being in seminary and doing ministry, right? That actually like this thing about myself that is something I struggle with and something that I, you know, that I struggle with, like kind of not liking about myself and also having to accept about myself, right? You know, is also this helpful tool or this helpful lens or something for ministry, right? That the two are suddenly intertwined. And it took me a while to be kind of to figure that out or to put language to that or to sort of develop, an acceptance of that. I write a bit in the book about there's a story in the New Testament, in the Gospel of Mark, this guy named Bartimaeus, who's healed by Jesus. And the word call is used three times in the story to talk about Bartimaeus. And Jesus calls Bartimaeus and his friends say, get up, he's calling you. And then he's called to Jesus. And the whole thing he's called to do is to be healed. That's it. So the term call is used repeatedly. It's the story about responding to a call, and the call is just to experience healing. And so for me, that was this sort of, that story was really helpful in kind of getting a bit of a new take on questions of vocation and call for myself, my own vocational identity, that sometimes my vocation is allowing myself to experience healing, even though that can sometimes be kind of a long, messy process, rather than illness being this barrier that stands between me and getting back to what I want to be doing, right? Getting back to kind of the doing of ministry. So I think a shift in sort of my self-identity and my understanding of vocation, and also a shift maybe in understanding ministry as kind of this series of tasks that I could complete hopefully successfully. And that actually this thing that had kept me from completing the tasks turned out to be like much more helpful than a lot of the tasks themselves, if that makes sense. So.
I'm sitting here and I'm in the room in the sense of somebody that's working in behavioral health, someone who's interested in behavioral health, and someone who has lamented losing or having to recover behavioral health. And I just remember when I was a patient, you know, when the chaplain walked in, which the irony is she became my supervisor my first year or internship year. You know, it was that question of where's God in all this suffering? You know, I had this strong faith. I'm doing what I'm supposed to do, and yet I'm still sick. Wasn't necessarily trying to take it in the direction of a discussion of theodicy, but more how did you wrestle with just those questions of illness, that illness narrative and that faith narrative? And I may be unfairly making those two different narratives, but how did you experience some of that?
Yeah. I think that question of like, where is God here is like such a powerful one. And the first two chapters in my book, I kind of set as sort of a, like holding tension with each other a bit. The first is about,
I remember that from your talk. I forgot about that narrative or dialectical tension. Sorry.
No worries. Yeah,
flashbacks.
Talk a bit about like the rubber band, right? And the when you pull on a rubber band, it's the tension between the two sides of the rubber band that actually do the work of the rubber band, right? You have to have the tension there for the rubber band to do anything. Otherwise, it's just you know, useless sort of thing that flops around. So,
like Charles.
And that's what Summer said.
Twice on Sabbaths.
No, that's what Summer said about you. Just this useless thing that flops around.
It's Wednesday.
I sort of knew as I was saying that that was going to
happen. Of course. You've heard one episode. Or been sentient the last 5 minutes of this one. No, I just thought that was, when I walked away from that talk at Wild Goose, I think I talked Charles's ear off about, like, wow, I had never thought of seeing my illness and my faith as any kind of Hegelian tension, and I would have never put it as simply and as eloquently as rubber band being pulled at two ends.
Yeah.
I had the most wonderful flashback to that moment from the Goose.
And that's the power of a good metaphor. It's simple, but it hits you because it expresses so much more than just the simple image.
Yeah, I sort of stumbled into that illustration because I found myself using the word tension so much that it was annoying me. You know, I was like, okay, I've said tension, you know, like 12 times in the past half hour. And so to kind of give some sort of, okay, like this is actually, like this is what I'm talking about, you know, rather than sort of like just using this sort of buzzword of like tension, tension, tension. But the first two chapters, the first one is about the presence of God and this sort of theological understanding of God being present exactly in places of hurt and suffering and struggle. The title Christ on the Psych Ward comes from this sort of prose poem type thing that I wrote in my journal while I was in the hospital. And this image of Christ being present with all of us who were there in this hospital and just sort of bearing along and sustaining us, to use language from the Epistle to the Hebrews, in exactly in the sort of hurt and the broken places. And then I write in the second chapter, I right away say, okay, like now we've got to talk about the absence of God, right? Because I want to say God is really present in the hurt and in the suffering. And that's exactly where, from a theological understanding, we sort of identify the solidarity of God. And also, like, it doesn't always feel like that, right? Like, it's not sort of
it
doesn't work as a band-aid over the, you know, it, like, wow, I feel like God is really not present here, and I feel really abandoned or really isolated or really alone. And that experience is really real, for lack of a better term. And, you know, lo and behold, our sort of scriptural resources that we have are actually really, really good at talking about that tension from beginning to end. And the Psalms in particular have, you know, kind of unfortunately become like fodder for sort of pastel colored like bookmarks and things like that. But like there are more laments.
That gets an amen. That gets an amen. If Charles said amen, he would say amen.
I do. Well, I do say amen. Do. That's where you guys got it from, you know.
Yeah, we stole
it. We said it first.
Yeah. Yeah. So, right. I mean, the Psalms are filled with lament, right? There's more lament Psalms than any other type of Psalm. And, they're the prayer book of the Bible is filled with language about God. Where are you? Why aren't you showing your face? Why have you turned away from us? Why have you abandoned us? Right.
Yeah. Christ's last words in Mark. Right.
Exactly. You
know, or taken lifted directly from Psalms.
Right. Yeah, precisely. Yeah, yeah. So I think that tension is very much, our tradition is very, very comfortable with it, but churches are very, very uncomfortable with it, right? So I think that's kind of an important piece to talk about there.
That kind of is one of the questions we were wondering about, and Charles had shared with me about being in ministry and that sort of,
Being vulnerable,
vulnerable. That's
and that how that impacts how your church or congregation, those to whom you minister, view you, and the seeming need for them to view you as strong and perfect, and how that dynamic then changes when you expose. No, I'm just as vulnerable as you are as a human being.
Yeah.
You know, and
which is odd. I'm going to push
it. Yeah, it is odd.
I'm going to say something, because now where I would challenge you on that, Charles, is that is probably more often a liability in the parish, but it's the essence of chaplaincy.
Yeah.
Is navigating that vulnerability. But yeah. I'm going to back out so he can answer the question. But yeah.
I'm trying to get that context.
Yeah, no, that's interesting what you just said about chaplaincy, because I went to seminary, and in the ordination process in the United Methodist Church and fully planning to be ordained and be a pastor in a local parish. And it wasn't like I found out I had a mental illness and then shifted plans, but I sure have ended up in chaplaincy positions rather than in parish ministry. I don't know that that will always be the case. You know, maybe in the future I'll find myself in parish ministry. But I do think that we project a lot of stuff onto religious leaders, right? Of invulnerability and of you know, there is power there that's important to acknowledge, but of sort of a personal power, kind of being impervious to the struggles within a congregation or within a community. And I think that a lot of pastors sort of take that on, right? Without realizing it, maybe not intentionally, some intentionally, but probably mostly unintentionally. So I think that actually, I think that in a sense I was lucky in that, as I kind of said earlier, I sort of like walked backwards into it. I wasn't really thinking that much about it, you know, sort of, if I, you know, had thought about it a bit more, I might've said like, maybe I should sort of protect myself here. And I didn't. And then that was actually really important and like really, really healthy for me to sort of be kind of forced to divest myself of some of that image of the guy who's got it all together or the guy who's got all the questions answered.
Because like for chaplains, I feel, I don't know what your experience has been, is that we're often in a better position to sojourn with people. Whereas when I was in the parish, it felt like I was always being pushed to lead from the front and didn't get to take that position of shepherd that I really felt more comfortable with. And that's kind of when I made the shift, when I was able to get my head right, or, you know, recover my mental health. Where I could see that that's not a liability, that's a strength. But I'm curious, just because this has been a personal journey for me, and which is again speaking to the interest in your book and your work. Could you say something about what it was like, or what it's been like, or is like for your sort of spiritual recovery? I mean, we rehab everything, you know, cognitively, physically. But that spiritual dimension, I guess I'm still searching for roadmaps to give others, you know, what has worked. But yeah, I'll pull back and let you wrestle with that one for a bit.
Yeah, no, it's a really important question. I think I sort of lucked out in a way. The long-term program I ended up in, the longer-term hospitalization, was at a place called Silver Hill Hospital in Connecticut, which like... some famous folks have been at Silver Hill, including Carrie Fisher. So I feel like I've kind of like walked the halls with greatness, but Silver
help
Hill.
Help me, Obi-Wan. Help
yeah,
me.
Seriously.
Princess Leia on the strike ward.
Yeah. Fellow ECT patient.
Yeah. Oh man. If for folks out there who struggle with mental illness and stuff, if you haven't read and addiction, both, if you haven't read Wishful Drinking by Carrie Fisher,
She does a live version of it.
Oh yeah,
on HBO.
Yeah. It's fantastic. It's so good. Man, may she rest in peace and power and hilarity, because just the way she tackles the issues of mental illness and addiction with like humor and honesty, it's amazing. Anyway, totally check it out. There's a quick digression there, but Silver Hill, because a lot of folks who are there are in recovery, have dual diagnosis of both a mental illness and an addiction or a substance use disorder, there's a 12-step spirituality is very much a part of the program there, and as is dialectical behavior therapy, which is a type of therapy that Marsha Linehan came up with after she sort of had a vision while praying in a chapel, and involves a lot of mindfulness practice and a lot of things that other people might not use the language about, but have kind of, for me, a spiritual component to them. So I think I lucked out in that I ended up in this, this kind of care and recovery environment where there was some sense of like, spirituality being a piece of this and questions of meaning and purpose being a piece of this. That was super helpful for me. And I think has helped me then in, yeah, I really like the term you use, that like spiritual rehabilitation, which for me has looked like a lot of kind of exploring once I was a bit more stable, right? Once the medication.
Yeah, you have to stabilize. Like, yes. Right,
then I was able to start asking questions about, well, like, what does this mean for me and my identity and how I understand myself? What does it mean? How do I come to understand medication? Potentially probably being on medication now for the rest of my life. How does that kind of intersect with how I understand my faith and healing and, you know, health and wholeness? So I talk a bit in the book about some different kind of metaphors for medication, and medication as a sacrament and medication as a
what? All right, man, you got to get, you can't drop a phrase like that and not unpack it a little.
Yeah, that's a heavy one, but that's great. Yeah.
I can't wait till spring 2018 to see what the devil that's.
Yeah. Very like old traditional Augustinian definition of a sacrament is an outward sign, outward visible, and I like to use the word tangible. You can touch it.
God, that's you're so Methodist, huh?
I know, yeah. this outward sign of a grace that's invisible, right? So I talk a bit about, you know, medication is this really ordinary, simple kind of daily thing that communicates something to me, both in very like in like physiological terms, but also in spiritual terms about the importance of my health, the importance of my wholeness, the importance of my kind of ability to function in the world. Right. And so that, you know, kind of, if I can name that in some language that's familiar to me from my spiritual tradition and from my religious tradition.
Yeah.
That helps, because otherwise, medication's really a pain in the ass, right? I mean, it's like,
it depends on how you're taking it. Yes.
Don't, if you're listening at home, don't try that with lithium. That's not
okay. Now that's the funny bit, because like one of the reasons Cuban cigars have a unique flavor is lithium in the soil, and having had Cuban cigars and having had to take lithium, I prefer the cigar version infinitely more to the pill.
Yeah. The year I had a colleague who used to get Cuban cigars, I didn't realize how depressed I was because I was self-medicating.
Well, that's
with the lithium for like a year and a half.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Oh man, I'm going to have to, all right. This is
right, a right.
new venue for research that I'm
But I really can resonate with that in the sense that in our brokenness is made whole in the act of consumption, taking in something tangible.
Right.
Spring of 2018 needs to hurry up and get here. But That's all I can say.
Since we are interfaithed.
We are?
Yeah, we are. Well, there's two Methodists and a Jew here.
So there's like seven opinions, right?
Well, plus you two. But when you said that, you know, medication is sacrament, what came to my mind is, you know, in Judaism, we have a blessing for everything. And so I was thinking, you know, so should I be saying a bracha when I take my meds in the morning? And, you know, there really is one, because it's sort of a catch-all one. But it really fits. It's one where for
well, recite it already.
Well, for food groups that don't fall into the specifics like bread or grains or, you know, fruit or things like that, it's just a, you know, blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who has blessed us with all of these gifts.
That'll work.
You know, and I'm thinking I'm going to start adding that in my mornings. You know, because you know the medication now is, you know, when you put it in those terms, that's, you know, really a part of it. And this is a time of year that I always struggle, especially the last 9 days and then tomorrow with Yom Kippur. You know, asking for another year of life and for forgiveness when, you know, that's the last thing you want when you're depressed is another year of this. And, you know, okay, and then forgiving yourself, you know, asking God to forgive you when you won't even do it yourself is always difficult. But I really thank you, you know, for putting it in those terms, using that metaphor for me. And seriously, I'm going to add that to my morning when I take my meds. Thank you.
Oh, that's so powerful too. Yeah. To be grateful for medication as a gift, right?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Which is just not how I've always thought about it. Right. I mean, it's mm-hmm. often been mm-hmm. like, oh gosh, do I have to do this? Right. And so, yeah, that's such a powerful kind of framing of that in the language of a spiritual tradition, I think. And I think those kind of things are things that, what's the right way to say this? Right. So like, I'm really grateful for the medical model and kind of the medical approach to mental illness, right? I take medicine,
yeah.
I was, you know, sort of saved by hospitals, but the medical model, you know, says like, take your meds. That's what you're supposed to do. You got to take your meds, right? The language for it is like compliance and non-compliance, which for a lot of people is really kind of alienating, right? I think a lot.
I find that with my patients and with myself, if I'm being totally honest, is the medical model also frees me up in the sense of this is not sin. This is disease.
Mm-hmm.
This is an illness. There's no morally value attributed to mental illness. I mean, in the sense that, you know, nobody sits around with cancer going, or at least I would think going, oh, I've done something horribly wrong. They may, but not in the same capacity with that stigma that comes with mental illness. I know, like in your pretty much all your social media feeds, and rightfully so, as someone that's in chaplaincy and ministry, trying to suggest and find ways for folks to get involved with persons with mental illness. And faith communities. Noted that you're a big fan of mental health first aid, which I am all about people getting. That's a great small group activity for any church, synagogue, mosque, temple, wherever two or more are gathered. It's what are some things from your experience, people, and I know in your book you touch on faith communities, that they can do to be present or and live alongside with is a better word.
Yeah.
Persons with mental illnesses.
Yeah. Well, I'll start with mental health first aid since you mentioned it. I think, so mental health first aid is a great training, right? It's a first responder training for non-professionals to kind of offer initial help to folks in mental health crisis. And like, think about the people in your church who aren't your pastor, who are the actual first responders. So
right.
who sits at the front
right.
desk of your church, right? Who are your ushers or your greeters? And the same with any kind of faith community. I'm saying church, right? But any kind of congregation, right? Who is the first person on the scene, right? Who helps people find their seats? Who's going to respond if somebody has a crisis in the middle of a worship service? It's probably not going to be the pastor, right? It's probably not going to be the person up front. It's going to be somebody who you might not think to get trained in this, right? Who could really, really use that first responder training. You know, who answers the phone?
Well, right? And clergy, local church clergy, almost the only thing that would be second to us, if not close, would be primary care physicians. But we're almost always one of the first persons to learn about a potential mental illness in a person because we have that, you know, well, I can trust the pastor. That's that whole confessional kind of moment, even for traditions that don't practice confession. But we are often the front line too.
Yeah. Yeah. And often a sort of, as a chaplain on a college campus, I talk a lot about how sometimes we play the role of the front door to resources, right? So
a student
will come and say, I'm having this problem. And, you know, I'll talk to them for a while. And then I'll say, well, you know, have you thought about, you know, going to the counseling center or going to the health services center or going to the LGBT center or going to, right. There's all these here at Georgetown. There's a massive number of resources available to students, but accessing them can be kind of intimidating. Right. And so if you've got a relationship with a chaplain or with a pastor who can kind of be your guide to the resources in a community, but that then puts on the chaplain or the pastor, right? The role you then need to know those resources, right? Which takes some work and research. But yeah, the, you know, walking students over to the counseling center, you know, going with a parishioner to their first counseling appointment or to the hospital. It was a clergy person who drove me to the hospital for the first time. Right. Which they don't put in your, you know, they don't necessarily put that in the job description. Right. But that sort of like
responder,
front door kind of stuff, I think is really important.
Yeah.
And we often talk about the tendency for persons of faith, and particularly clergy, of mistakenly over spiritualizing a response. In the sense of, you know, we're just going to pray about it. It's like, oh, that's great, but let's get in the car and go to the emergency room while we're doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's something my wife deals with. She's director of Jewish life at Wake Forest University. And, you know, she's had that same experience. Well, first of all, there's always a chaplain on call. Yeah. Anytime a student has any kind of issue, one of the calls is always to a chaplain. But she's had, you know, students that have, you know, talked to her about things, and not only has she helped them with the research, but yeah, she's said, okay, you know, in her office, okay, come on, we're going over to the counseling center.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or we're going to go to the hospital. You know, that is an important part of her job. But also I agree with you on not just clergy, especially the ushers and greeters.
Yes.
Because sometimes the person themselves may not recognize it themselves. Yeah. But that first person who sees you, hi, welcome, how are you doing today? That's an important question. And if they're trained with the mental health first aid to really listen to the response and you know, this person, you've seen them, and they just don't look themselves. Their affect is off.
And
how they respond to that, you know, those people, those front line, that's so, so important to get that training. So, you know, I like that you brought that up too. It's not just the professionals. Yeah, the secretary, you know, who's ever in the front office, office manager, whoever, that's important because they have that contact. But the other members of the community who see them, the ushers, especially those greeters, you know, that's the first person you see when you come into the building.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking youth ministry. Yeah, because I did that for a number of years, and that's would also be a worth it. Really, if you're working with anybody on a regular basis, even a volunteer, do yourself the favor. It's like what it's an 8-hour course.
I did it for like it was like a day that I took to do it.
Yeah.
And when I did mine, I got it for free through the DC Department of Behavioral Health, and I'll say two things. One is that there's a particularly like targeted for youth module of it. If you're a youth
worker. Oh, really? Okay.
Worth checking out. And, I did it. A big chunk of the folks who were in the class with me were hospital security guards, which I thought was brilliant, right? Like a really good example.
Brilliant. Yes.
Here you have a facility filled with health professionals, but sometimes the first person on the scene is, you know, the security guard who doesn't have that training. So here's a way for them to have some resources when they're responding to a situation where they're like, they can make an assessment and say, you know, this person is having a mental health crisis. Like this person isn't intending to threaten anyone, isn't intending to scare anyone. They're in mental health crisis. And that's the framework we need to respond to this. I thought that was amazing that this hospital had like, sent. I wish I remembered what hospital it was, but because I just wanted to like write them to send them kudos because they sent their whole basically security department to this training. I was like, yes, you know, that's perfect. That's excellent. So, yeah. So mental health first aid is a great resource for congregations. I'd say thinking through some of the ways that we have, that we respond to people when they're in illness, as churches or as faith communities, that kind of come naturally to us that we tend to not think about when it comes to mental illness. So, mental illness, I've heard it said, is a non-casserole disease. Right. So like, you know, if somebody's sick, we, you know, or if there's been a death in a family, you know, faith communities know how to show up with the casseroles and to sort of do that, you know, that kind of basic care stuff. And then with mental illness, there tends to be such a culture of silence and stigma around it that same response often doesn't happen. So yeah, what are some of the ways that we really know how to respond as faith communities that we tend to forget about when it comes to mental health and mental illness? Mm-hmm. Is another kind of important question.
Wow. No, we are right there with you with the casserole illness.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it is, I'm at a loss for words just because I previously was the Methodist to Charles's madness, but he's slowly actually collecting a gaggle of us. whereas he's my only Jew, he has a number of Methodists with him. He's the Pied Piper of the Wesleyan type.
That's good. Somebody's got to collect them. I mean,
well, it is.
Well, we've been wandering for 40 years, so.
Yeah, and between the two of us, he's definitely closer to going on to perfection than I'll ever be. So.
Yeah. So, well, here, I'll name one more sort of to talk about resources since you mentioned wandering
for 40 years,
right? I think the spiritual resources that we have as communities are really important to just like think through, like how do we bring them to bear when it comes to people's questions of around mental health and mental illness. And so in the book, I talk a bit about the story of manna in the desert and of enough of the manna. If you try to collect too much of it, right, it spoils. If you don't collect enough of it, you find out you still have enough. And I relate that to this thing I did in the hospital that we called the victory column. And the deal with the victory column was I could put points in the victory column for anything. So it was like, I got out of bed this morning, so I put that in the victory column, right? And I took a shower. So I was like,
I'm stealing that. That's good CBT right there.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Finished a meal, victory column, right? There was no defeat column, right? So it was only the victory column. And so I talk about that as sort of like going around and gathering the bits of manna, right? Like it wasn't this abundance of good in my life. I couldn't feel any that, right? I could do was gather these little bits and sort of say, that's enough. That's enough. Like that's enough for today. That'll get me through this day. So we have, I mean, I think like we have these incredible resources. The narratives of our spiritual traditions are so rich with a wealth of interpretation that can really be brought to bear on these conversations. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes we just haven't known how to do that.
Wow. I'm stealing that. I'll give you credit for it. But that
yeah.
Group for Wednesday is now taking care. But no, people will laugh at that. But honest to goodness, when you're at that acute stage of recovering from that illness, of any mental illness, it is that, you know, hey, I got pants on today.
Yeah.
I mean, because that's how you've got to take those little steps before. I mean, it's the cliche, but it's cliche that's truth. You got to walk before you can run. And to be honest, it's kind of like you got to be able to crawl before you can walk and to not be ashamed of that.
It's also important. And it's part of the narrative that we've been trying to change around mental health is unlike one of the differences is this isn't something that you are cured of. Mm-hmm. This is something you live with. It is who you are.
Well, you live with a degree. Or recovery remission. I think remission language is helpful for some of us.
It is, but it's you live with this. So anything that makes that possible.
Yeah.
Those are the victories.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why to other people that they sound so trivial. Oh, well, yeah, you got out of bed today. No, that's big. That means I am living.
Yeah.
You know, this is not something that, you know, I just, you know, is I'm going to be different tomorrow and I'm no longer going to be a depressive, you know, that I am. I refer to myself as a functioning depressive.
Yeah.
Well, most of the time I'm functioning anyway.
Right.
But it, you know, it, we live with this and, definitely I think you've given us some good, metaphors and sources, especially because that's where we have started is, you know, what do we have in our faith traditions? And, you know, we've offered a few ourselves, and you've really been adding a lot to that discussion, and we really, really thank you. And yeah, very much looking forward to this book coming. And you know, you'll be back when the book comes out, and we can
I just say it gives us a chance for future, and
get more in depth.
Yeah,
because it's definitely needed. These conversations are needed. Your book's just going to be one more resource that people are going to have.
And yeah, I mean, I remember when you said the title, the first thought in my mind was, oh, I got to go back to the Wild Goose bookstore and buy that like right after this. And then the next phrase was 2018. And in my head, I'm going, damn.
Yeah.
It's July.
I feel the same way, for what it's worth. I'm so ready to have this thing in hard copy. You know? Yeah. But well, thank you all so much for the work you're doing. I mean, talking about this topic is, I think, there's so much silence, right, still, that just like any conversation we can have about this, and any way that we can kind of get, folks in society in general, but I think there's particular stigmas that kind of obtain in the faith communities. The effort to talk about it and break the silence around it is so important. So really grateful for the work you all do.
We are both grateful for your work, and that not in the you glad handing pat on the back because you're on the show. No, we're both fans, as you can tell, and just glad your voice is there. And you know, good luck, God go with you, whatever is comfortable language. But with chaplaincy starting up, I have no doubt that experience that you have both personally and with your education, your theological training, you're going to be, not that you need it again to have that pat on the back, but you're going to be a blessing. And I can say that as a former patient, more folks like you speaking up, just being in the room and saying, you know what, I used to be a patient. That phrase right there, I have seen that brighten people up in the psych unit I serve in a way that others that don't have that story can go there.
Yeah, I see that when I volunteer at the cardiac rehab, the cardiac rehab where I'm at. It's the only place in the hospital where, in order to volunteer, you have to have been a patient.
Oh, wow!
And we're there specifically for that, to say to people, "Hey, I know what you're going through.
Yeah,
you know, I've been through this process, and just watching how that can help lift and." You know, personally having experienced it, knowing what the volunteers did for me. So,
yeah, if he had a few more Virgil Caine rye whiskeys, he would take his shirt off and show his scar. So,
than the language, we're trying to keep this, you know, kind of PG here. So,
why now?
Yeah, right. Why start now? But one of the things that we do, we're trying to get us toward wrapping up, because we could keep going with this for a long time, but you know, to shamelessly plug, we know you have someone there, and I'd like to just give her a chance to chime in if she wants
to.
Penny Lane have anything she wants to add?
Hey, yeah? Penny, you want to say hi?
Hi, Penny.
Finally an articulate guest on this show.
Good job.
So yeah, check out,
she may be replacing one of us soon.
So check out David on at Twitter. He's at Foolish Hosey, Hosey.
Yeah.
Hosey on Twitter. His blog is foolishhosey.blogspot.com.
Yeah.
And his pod,
go ahead. Christonthepsychward.com. And that'll take you now.
We didn't have that link.
Yeah, ChristOnThePsychWard.com will bounce you to the page on my blog where there's an excerpt from the book, and you can pre-order there. And I'll actually be turning that eventually. That'll be its own independent website that'll have resources and discussion guides and lots of different things there. So, yeah.
Where the real money in the ministry is made.
Yeah.
Merchandising.
That's right.
Christ on the Psych World, the t-shirt.
The flamethrower. Kids love it.
I keep telling Lee, my spouse Lee, I keep saying, you know, well, I hear next year the chaplaincy business is really going to take off. You know, we'll really be in the money. So.
So Charles,
yes, Chris.
Since you've not said anything else wise in the entire time we've been broadcasting these long years, do you have words of wisdom today for us?
I do have words of wisdom, and there is no ulterior motive or hidden agenda other than today is Miguel de Cervantes' birthday. Some of you may know him as the author of Don Quixote. And this is not a Don Quixote quote. And again, I just picked this at random for no particular reason.
No particular reason. Nah.
None at all. And Cervantes famously wrote, "How will he who does not know how to govern himself know how to govern others?"
Well, I'm Chris Henson, and I'm still the Gentile.
And I'm Charles Breton, and I'm still the Jew.
And we invite you to join us next time when a Jew and a Gentile
walk into a bar mitzvah.
I've been kicking myself over things.